I'm going to be giving today's talk on PostgreSQL. It'll be a reasonably advanced talk, mostly designed for people who are either familiar with SQL or familiar with PostgreSQL. I'll be using the term PostgreSQL, PostgreSQL, or Postgres interchangeably. You should probably all be familiar with it. Okay, just some history of Postgres before we get into the swing of things. Postgres was originally spawned from work on Ingress at Berkeley University in California. That work took place from 1977 to 1985. It was transformed into an object relational database back in 1986, and that work continued throughout the 80s into the early 90s, back into 93. Actually, just before I forget, you should have some evaluation forms. If you don't, up the back. I've been asked just to remind you if you could all please fill those in, because I think people have been forgetting or something like that. Other administrative note, lots of people seem to be keen to talk about things like replication and stuff which basically just doesn't fit into a talk kind of format. I'm happy to run a Postgres BOF or work with other people who want to run a Postgres BOF or whatever. Tomorrow evening is probably the best time. So if you want, I'll sort one out for tomorrow evening. Getting back to it. SQL support for Postgres was added back in 1995, contrary to the fact that it was an academic project which was originally trying to do something different to SQL. That's why it was actually at the time called PostQL. It was, again, another half pun on this SQL nomenclature. But the demand for SQL support was too high, and as such, SQL support was added and has been increasingly developed and brought into standards compliance since then. Just after that, in 96, there was an appeal by the then two maintainers of the project for help from the open source community. Any of you who were involved in open source back then will know that around about 96 really was a year when open source took off, and five or six developers replied to the original request. They were experienced C programmers. They had more often than not already been using the database anyway. They realised basically how buggy it was and wanted to get more involved. The focus, given their experience with the database, was on really just cleaning up the code. That took about 6 months to restructure the code, to riddle out all the complexity which all those years of academia and academic development had brought into the code, and to start processing the bug and patch list, which was huge. I mean, people from all over the world, just like in any other large open source project, had been submitting patches to have the project do what they wanted, but no one had had the time or expertise or knowledge of that particular concept in order to bring it in. So it was a lot of work really stabilizing the code. And naturally, once you stabilize code, more people get interested, it's more reliable, and that saw a real takeoff in the usage of Postgres. The project was renamed PostgresQL. PostgresQL, if anyone even cares, is the correct way to pronounce it, but most people just say Postgres. It's now run, and all code is copyrighted by the Postgres Global Development Group. So now, we have regular development cycles. Postgres community usually says they're 6 months. In reality, they're about 9 to 12 months. The reason why the development cycle takes so long is over the last, say, 2 years, the releases have had such significant changes between versions. For example, in 7.3, we saw the addition of schemas, SQL 92, 99 compliant schemas. We saw the addition of dependency code, which touched 95% of commands and routines. We saw reworking of some of the WoW stuff. We saw complete reworking of the type system. Large sections of the code get touched. About 100,000 odd lines were rewritten, and I think it was about 87-odd thousand lines of C were added. So, hence the fact that it's such a long development cycle. It's a contentious topic because, obviously, with all those new features flooding in over a 12-month period, people want to get access to it, and the CVS versions are never stable enough, obviously, to run in production. Minor releases are always strictly bug fixes. No new features are introduced in those minor releases. And for that reason, Postgres is able to boast that, generally speaking, it is a very stable open source application. It rarely has bugs which affect the actual persistence and integrity of the data, which is obviously extremely important with the database. Unfortunately, back in 7.2 series, we did have three data corruption issues, one which related to vacuuming as non-super user. So if anyone's using 7.2.1 or 7.2.2, they should upgrade to 7.2.3 because there is a very serious bug there, who Chris, if he's here, can tell you about, I think. There was a couple of late nights on the list with that one. And there was a few other minor, much rarer case bugs. But other than that, back in the 7.1 and 7.0 series, from memory, we didn't actually have any data corruption issues. Again, coming back to the fact that we had this regular, drawn-out, long-term development cycle, which involves usually 3 months of beta testing. As I said, new features are being constantly added. In fact, a lot of the things which I will cover later on in the talk, saying that you know we don't have support, or we don't have SQL compliance for that, are currently being worked on. So there really is a very large degree of development. Increasingly, we're seeing new stock, as it were, coming into the development community, particularly Neil Young, who works out of Canada, who is just, oh, I can't talk about this guy enough, like he's an amazing developer. He's only 18 years of age. As far as I know, he's never even really worked in commercial industry, and yet he's now working in point-in-time recovery, which is pretty damn serious stuff. We have commercial support really picking up speed. That's run through PostgreSQL Inc., which is run out of Nova Scotia, which is one of the core developers. Shouldn't be confused with the Postgres development community or anything like that. And Red Hat, for example, their Red Hat DB, which you probably all know about, is based on PostgreSQL. They provide a few additional applications, all of which, mind you, are open source and available to the PostgreSQL community, but they do offer professional services and so on. They also employ the central developer involved in Postgres, Tom Lane. We're now seeing installations which are greater than a terabyte in size. For example, on would have been on the 1st of January this year, Afilias, who have a subsidiary called Liberty RMS, took over control of the .org registry. That .org registry looks after 2 million odd domain names from memory, and that's all being now run out of PostgreSQL. Anyone who comes to the BOF, I'll attempt to get the URL to a discussion on ICANN relating to that. Oracle accused ICANN of criminal negligence for allowing someone to put in a proposal based on an open source database, and said that everything should run on Oracle because Oracle's the best, it's unbreakable, all this sort of crap. And some of the ICANN guys shot them down, saying that the price of buying a .org domain would have to go up so significantly based on the proposals put in, because they were running them on E10Ks and 64 CPU licenses and all this sort of stuff to guarantee that it wouldn't go down, that they wouldn't look at them. So Liberty RMS, or Afilias as they're also called, won the proposal, so now we've got .info and .org running out of PostgreSQL, as well as many other applications. Is there any questions so far? It's pretty basic stuff. If anyone has a question at any time, just feel free to jump in. I may be answering it later on in my talk, so in which case we'll delay it, but if you've got a burning question, knock yourself out. Okay. Just some quick basics. I'm sure that most of you have probably installed or used Postgres before. Installation of Postgres, however, is by the standard configure make install. Some interesting arguments to configure are things like prefix. The reason why I suggest this is that Postgres does have one major flaw. It has a few major flaws. The hottest one for myself and for my clients, other than replication, is table spaces. Not Oracle-style table spaces with a file system and all that sort of stuff, because anyone who's admin to Oracle will know just how bad it is. Or anyone who's actually admin to Unix box that's had an Oracle admin set up table spaces will know just how bad it is. Table spaces, when I speak about them, and I'll probably go into more detail at a BOF, would involve the ability to choose the location of any single object in the database and have it stored there. This is particularly useful if you have lots of disk arrays running on different channels, different speed disks, because you could play with the planar in order to get better performance. You might have something like solid state disk for very hot tables in your database and so on. We don't support that currently, so fiddling around with things like prefix and its related arguments will allow you to put, say, binaries on one disk and install the actual data aspect of your setup on another disk channel or on another RAID array or something like that. Naturally, people should generally be running it on a good quality disk. It is a database and integrity is important. Other interesting arguments, enable NLS. This is native language support. For any of you who prefer, say, German to English, PG port is something that I use quite regularly, obviously, in development. This allows you to change the default port, which is 5432, to something else, for example, 5433. With OpenSSL, allows you to build in OpenSSL support, which will allow you to encrypt connections. Very important if you're doing it over a public network. You can also make check at installation time, which will allow you to actually test that all the regression tests which the community have put together work on your system. It's not very computationally intensive, takes about 5 minutes. We don't usually get that many problems with this for stable releases. But if you have a unique kind of setup, if you've just deployed it on your VMS machine or something like that, we might have some issues there. We often have them with different Solaris setups, for example, because of differences in sorting algorithms, differences in precision on time and so on. But generally speaking, it should be ready to go. So, post-installation, Postgres does not run at root. It will not run as root. For that reason, you need to add a user. The most popular user is, of course, Postgres. You need to make a directory for the data, which is where the actual data files for the database live. You'll notice that I've specified a path to the data directory. That was intentional, going back to that issue of separating where the actual data lives from perhaps other disk which is being used more intensely. That data needs to belong to Postgres, of course, and then the database can be initialized using initdb, which sets out all the directory structure and hierarchy, and then to start it you can use pgctl. So, concepts. Started to focus in this talk on some of these real background kind of concepts, because a lot of the time when I give a talk, some of the things I refer to aren't blatantly obvious. So I'm really going to focus for about the next half an hour or so on concepts underlying Postgres. The first one is the easiest, dealing with the object hierarchy within Postgres. At the highest level, you have the database, and databases hold all that stuff in them. There can be several databases under Postgres, as you all probably know. Within a database is a schema. If those of you who use Postgres that haven't used 7.3 probably won't be familiar with schemas as yet, unless, of course, you've used other database systems which support schemas. Schemas are essentially just a namespace. They provide a level of abstraction on top of the database, however. For example, you could set up a schema in a shared database, but make it specific to some application which you are running out of the database. If you're a DBA, and particularly if you don't know what an application is going to do when it logs in, because it's perhaps a proprietary application or was developed by someone other than yourself, or you're not even a programmer, then you want to really relegate that application to a space of its own so that it can't clobber any of the other tables by mere coincidence of naming. One could also argue that that should be isolated in its own database for a few reasons. That's not really necessary any longer. I mean, the biggest reason is that schemas are now supported, but secondly, it might need to access some data in your table, in your database, which you've set up, and there's certain performance related concepts. Opening a lot of databases increases the amount of the impact on shared memory, which I'll go into later on. Within a schema, or schemas, are relations. Relations consist of either a table or a view. We get the word relation from set theory. It's simply a set, or a table, as most people refer to it as. A tuple is an instance of a relation, what we generally refer to as a row. An attribute, therefore, going back to that object or set style theory, is a column, and an object ID is a unique identifier used by PostgreSQL in order to identify a unique object. Are there any questions about that nomenclature? Excellent. Mm-hmm. I'll be getting to that, yes. Postgres most definitely supports joins. Or do you mean something more specific when you say a relationship? Postgres does, and I'll go into it later on, does support things like foreign keys, for example, which is, I think, what yes. Postgres supports, in order to do that, supports things like triggers, rules, which are not SQL compliant, supports cascading on foreign keys, that if, say, you delete a key in one table which is intrinsically related to another, that will cascade through and delete the related tuples from there. Yep. Per SQL 99, schemas can reach across. Queries can reach across schemas. Those of you who are familiar with schemas would be familiar with this kind of syntax. Select. We might have A dot B. I've got a black. I need to really get rid of that one. That thing. Oh, I'll probably break something. Okay. Better? Or it's just, okay. Excellent. Say I have a query that runs something like this. Select A dot B from, select A dot B dot C from B. A would be the schema, B would be the table, and C would be the actual column. We also have this concept of search path, which is SQL compliant, I think. Search path specifies the search order. So if you don't specify a schema, you just say select B from C, or select C from B for that matter, it will look in the highest level search order, which might be the special case $user, which is the schema which you've been which has been specified by the DBA against your username. It might be something like public, which is the shared schema. It might be PG underscore catalog, which is the system catalog. That search order, I'd love a darker pen. That search order runs left to right, and generally speaking, it will, by default, be strictly public. So that when you log in, if you do a select, you do not qualify any of your references to tables or objects, it will look in that current schema, which will be public. Once you get a more sophisticated database and start specifying user as the top level in the search order, it will look in your personal schema. Did that answer your question, sorry? Not really. Sorry? Well, definitely a bot subject. I wasn't sure if how many people would want detail on schema. I will talk about it further once I start looking at the features, but generally speaking, that's it. I'll look at how to define a schema per user so that when they log in automatically, they'll be in their own schema. And I think I've got some examples of the syntax in queries. Sure. The first example that I gave, where say you have multiple applications all playing in the same database. So one application, you've got several developers all working on these different applications using a shared resource, which is, you know, the general idea behind Unix style computing. They're all doing all kinds of things. They're just creating data tables randomly, whatever. You don't want them to start clobbering each other's work. So it's a level of abstraction to isolate those users. It almost behaves like a database unto itself, except for the fact that in a production style situation, tables shared by several applications or by several mechanisms within a single application could be put into the public space because it's a shared resource. Application specific tables could be put into that user level schema or into some other schema in recognition of the fact that they are a private style, or the data is private to that aspect of the application. If you compare it to, say, object orientation theory, where you have namespace control, say, in C++, where a class can actually hide, effectively, some data components of the class by specifying them as private, can expose them to other aspects of the class and to the application at large by specifying them as public, that's the general idea. You can restrict access to your schema, so there's a security aspect to it, and it also has the ability to simplify application development. For example, in an application one of my clients has running on 7.2.3, there's a database with maybe about 580 tables, I think, at last count. And, you know, that's about 2 or 3 odd gig in size, and it's sometimes hard to play with, especially when it's not really my database, so the company's developers are working on this and they encounter the kind of problems that I just spoke about, running into namespacing issues. Then they start creating tables with names like underscore, underscore, blah, and yeah, it can be a real pain in the ass at that large end of things. And for the reason of SQL compliance. That's another big reason. The ability to take SQL code from one application and plug it into a different database is a serious goal of SQL. That was the original intention behind it. Unfortunately, no database, including Postgres, completely supports SQL 99. Most databases are quite far from it. Any other questions? I'll make these notes available, and at the BOF you can easily leech them off my laptop, but yeah, I'll put up a URL somewhere outside or something like that so that everyone knows. Any other questions? In fact, One of the things I need to do, and this is something I might talk about at the BOF as well, I'm trying to ramp up advocacy of Postgres. One of the things I'm going to be doing for that is producing a list of papers and trying to ensure that the original authors keep them up to date. That isn't as hard as it sounds because there's only about five people who are doing this kind of thing, and most of them are pretty switched on except for me. If you are involved, if you use Postgres and if you read, say, the announce, pgsql-announce at postgresql.org mailing list, I'll probably be mailing around about that. Probably also be discussed widely on pgsql-advocacy@postgresql.org. So there will be a shared resource, and hopefully, this is if I find enough time, we'll also be producing a calendar for up and coming talks, because I do maybe five of these style conferences a year. Bruce does way more, and there's a lot of discussion about Postgres. In fact, I was surprised that there's no discussion about MySQL this year, which is, I think, the first year at Linux.conf.au. David Uxmark hasn't spoken about it. That's very interesting because they also, this is the MySQL guys, had a very negative reaction to OSCon. Meanwhile, Postgres community thought it was unbelievable how much coverage we got. So, yeah, there's an interesting dynamic working there. Any other questions? Sure. For XML. Nowhere near what you would say Oracle has or IBM. Naturally, people will experience with, say, databases or with XML would have some idea using a parser of how to get the data in to it. But Postgres currently, it won't be the case in 7.4, but currently doesn't have hierarchical style search capabilities. That is, those of you familiar with Oracle would be familiar with start with connect by, hierarchical querying. SQL 99 calls it with recursive. Traditionally, the relational concept, some argue that it's flawed, joins things like straight away. So if you have two tables, they share values in a particular column, you join them across that value. Hierarchical data storage mechanisms, shall we call them, such as XML or SGML or any other example, actually has children. It's a hierarchical system. Postgres does not have the ability to simply, that is, connect those children in a single query. There is a contrib package called ConnectBy, I think it is, just basically taking the Oracle style naming, which implements a mechanism to search hierarchically, which is very much necessary to provide any level of convenience when it comes to storage of XML. Joe Conway, who is Joe at joeconway.com, is, I think, the author of ConnectBy, and was talking about XPath searching, or so I don't really know a lot about XML. I know enough about XML to question the usefulness of XML storage in a database. I didn't mean that to sound too harsh, but that's probably, that opinion is shared by, say, myself and the core developers, which is why there hasn't been a lot of support for it. But there probably is something in contrib or at gborg.postgresql.com, which I mentioned at the end of the slides. Sure, yeah, that's actually the way that I would like to see XML used more, instead of having clients bug me to use it in place of a binary protocol. But it's probably the best idea. If anyone who's tried to pull data out of Oracle knows what I'm talking about. It's a real pain in the ass. Some people sort of go, oh, but Postgres isn't SQL compliant enough to move my application across from Oracle. It's like, that's the least of our problems, really. So, not much work on XML, probably a contrib package, probably something on gborg.postgresql.org, which was all the work that came out of Great Bridge, any of those who have been around Postgres that long, but nothing in CDS or the main CDS tree. Any other questions before I proceed? Okay, some basic architecture of Postgres. This is what really sets Postgres apart, in my opinion, this very distinct structure. Ignoring the first point in the flowchart called main, the tab underneath it, Postmaster, is like the Apache super server kind of concept. It's essentially a traffic cop which does a little bit of routing and sets up things like shared memory and all that sort of stuff. But after it's done the first aspect of it, all it's doing is handling servicing incoming connections, passing the socket down into a child process. The reason I mention it is lots of people, time and time again, will run up Postgres and suddenly they'll run a PS and they'll see that there's a process called Postmaster, there's a process called Postgres colon stats A, process called Postgres colon stats B, and then processes like Postgres. The Postgres processes are the actual backends which are servicing queries. As you can see on the third tier there, for every single connection, there is a forked backend. The Postmaster is, as I said, simply that super server handling incoming connections. It also does a few other minor things like checkpointing the write-ahead log and servicing statistics requests, but it doesn't actually launch backends as such. They're just pseudo backends. They're just childs with limited functionality, shall we say. So the important thing to remember is that every connection has a Postgres process to service it. This unfortunately means that startup time is much higher than has traditionally been much higher than competing databases because of that forking cost and because of the cost of setting things up again and again. But under operating systems such as Linux, as opposed to Solaris, which forks really badly, the cost really isn't as significant, I think, as most people really make it out. Just going through a single query then. The query will come in from the Postmaster, a backend will be launched, some initialization kind of stuff will take place, then we'll hit the parser. The parser is written, well, the first aspect of the parser is written in Yak, as are, you know, many other large-scale parsers. The parser is absolutely huge, it needs lots of work. The Yak parser is about 6,000 to 8,000 lines from memory. It has way too many rules in there. We've really got to clean it out. Might even have to ditch Yak, but nonetheless, it's a Yak-based parser. The Yak node, which comes out at the end, internal representation of the query, gets passed into a second-level parser, you might say. That simply starts to do some validation, starts to translate some of the strings and numbers into internal representations, and gets it ready to be passed on to the traffic cop. The traffic cop is a very, very simplistic parse tree. In fact, it's just a switch. Inside the first level parser, we've identified exactly what type of query we are. We know whether it's a select, an insert, a delete, an update, a create user, create table, create schema, drop schema, whatever. Every single possible use at the SQL level. And then we start to service that out to the particular specific subroutines. Naturally, this allows us to very discreetly lay out our source code. If we are what's listed on the diagram, a utility command, like create database, create user, vacuum, analyze, anything which does not involve the actual retrieval or storage of data is a utility command. They don't need to run through the rewriter or planner or the other levels there. They simply get serviced. And they're usually pretty simplistic routines. If, however, we are a a query, which is retrieving or storing data in the database itself, we need to hit the rewriter and the planner. How many of you are familiar with the rewriter under Postgres? Rule use. Excellent. That's good. I'm not boring people. Well, I'm not boring them too much. The rewriter is a excellent tool under Postgres. The rewriter allows you to identify an incoming query, such as a select on a given table, and actually redirect it to another table, for example, or change the actual attributes which it affects. This means that you can do profoundly complicated operations with very little development time involved. The best application I've ever seen of this is by a company called Cybertech. I think they're an Austrian company. They did a project for the Austrian government, which was based around looking after social security type matters, looking after all citizens in Austria. The problem that they had to solve was just some data mining related applications, basically just looking at trends over time. Most application designers would simply just record changes, timestamp them, and be done with it. Unfortunately, there were enough changes to actually blow out the size of the table significantly. I mean, Austria already has how many millions of people? And then for every single change to their social security status, you have to add a new instance to a table. What Hans actually did was, and this is actually on GBorg, was to develop a journaling style format using another aspect of Postgres and SQL called inheritance, which works just like inheritance in object orientation. Using rules, he was actually able to identify modifications to the, say, master citizen table, and instead of just updating that table and losing the previous status, put it in a subsequent, a different table, thereby not changing the existing table. Using more rules and using inheritance, he was able to provide a seamless view of this, however, so that instead of querying millions and millions and millions of entries in a event kind of log, he was able to keep the data relatively static and only store differences. He essentially wrote a diff tool at SQL level. The brilliance of this was only seen when they started playing around with it in debugging. They started to see that some people in a particular part of Vienna were coming back to life. I'm not joking, coming back to life. This is what was happening. Every 3 months or so, one of the people working for the government decided that she was a little short of cash. She would receive in a notification that some person had died and therefore they don't need their equivalent of the pension anymore, and that was it. You put through, I'd say, 100 of these things a day, or maybe even more. Occasionally, she would forget to do one and redirect the postal address. Sorted. She gets herself a pension. And she was doing this about every 3 months. So this just shows some of the... And this application is remarkably fast. With their previous application, I think they were only able to do analysis 2 times a day on it, and it was running on an old HPUX machine. And now they're running on an AIX machine, I think it takes only about 10 minutes to run their application, just simply because they're using these built-in mechanisms within Postgres, as opposed to actually having to hit the data really, really hard. Another example which I heard from a colleague in, where is he? He must be in North America. In northern USA. He was doing some analysis, a rules-based system for an insurance company. He was using rules and he was also using some of the other aspects of Postgres. In the end, there was about 80,000 rules in the database, and it started to actually get so accurate that they were seeing anomalies, and they thought it was this catastrophic problem with their database. and they were all worried, they'd done it wrong. They'd already been sitting down with actuaries and claims assessors and all this sort of crap for about 2 years, and so they were devastated. Once they actually started looking at the data a little harder, they realised that it was a single assessor making a mistake about every 6 months, like grossly paying out a claim to an extreme degree. And she was simply corrupt. Like, she was just paying out their claim a little higher because some lawyer had given more money. This was life insurance. And that was that. But the very fact, I mean, that sounds like it has very little relevance, but the very fact that a rule-based system and a rewriting engine is built into Postgres allows you to greatly increase the performance of this analysis style, this data mining style work. But because it's so simple, you're just saying, instead of querying this table, query that table. Instead of inserting this data into this table, do it into that table, and then concatenating tables together and so on, you can get these kind of results quickly. But moving on from the rewriter, unless anyone has any questions. Okay. The other point there is generate plans. That should actually probably be another tab unto itself. Generate paths, sorry. What do we do when we generate paths? The difference between, say, an SQL or a database server and a database mechanism like Berkeley DB or SleepyCat DB is that we actually, it's actually based on this concept that disk is way more expensive than CPU in terms of usage. This means that if we can do a few mathematical sums at a reasonably small CPU, reasonably small cost in time, because CPUs are really, really fast, then we can save the amount of disk we actually have to access. When we generate paths, we take this idea to the extreme and actually look at every possible way that we can get the data from the hard disk. And it's still comparatively cheap to do. To do that, we just use a basic arbitrary costing model, which I'll go into detail a little bit later. We then, of course, choose the cheapest of all paths. In the next step, we pass that path or plan off to the executor, and the executor actually then goes through and says, this is a select, I need to get data from this particular block on disk, this particular TID or tuple ID within that particular page, and so on. It gets the data, works out where to send it back, and we get it back at our query. Are there any questions about how that a query is actually serviced under this architecture then? Okay. Okay, another very, very important and distinguishing aspect of Postgres is transactions. Transactions allow us to encapsulate work and guarantee the integrity of our data. This is remarkably important when working with databases, particularly databases which are, say, worth a lot of money, such as databases handling financial information, which are directly involved in a company's, primary income stream or whatever. Under Postgres, there are two types, shall we say, of transactions. There is the transaction that is launched for each and every query. That is, you connect to Postgres, or say you connect via PSQL, you type in select star from pg_class and get a list of all the tables which are in the database. That query was actually run with inside a transaction. The reason why we use that framework is, say, three quarters of the way through processing the query, we find that the data is corrupt on disk, we have to error out because we have to tell the user that we can't service the particular query successfully, or some other equally catastrophic problem occurs. We need a transaction for each query for that reason, so that we can back out at any point within that query running, even if it's the very last aspect of it. The second type of transaction is probably the transaction which people are generally familiar with. That is the transaction block. You type begin, you run however many queries, and then you type commit at the end, and everything's nice. So Postgres supports both of those. Under 7.3, we have a mechanism called auto-commit. That is, the first type of query that I spoke about is what's termed an auto-committed transaction. Using the configuration files or using Duck, which I'll detail later on, you are able to turn auto-commit off so that the first query, which is executed by the application or by the user, actually keeps its transaction open. It essentially just saves a single line and it replicates the behavior of Oracle. Do people understand that concept? No. Okay. Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, yeah. To all intents and purposes, it's a little more low level than that. But it before a query is run, if it's not already in a transaction block, Postgres, to all intents and purposes, issues a begin before it starts to process it. And when it gets to the end, if it's not in a transaction block, it issues a commit. That's almost essentially what happens. This is why we introduced auto-commit. If you're not already in a transaction block, that is, if a user has not already explicitly specified begin semicolon, then by default, we have to commit at the end. We don't want to leave the transaction hanging. We want to commit what the user has done to the database. When you set auto-commit to off, it ignores that final step of committing the transaction, even if it was only a single select query or the most minute interaction with the database. Even if that's the only thing that it does, it still leaves it open. Sorry, does that clarify it at all? Yes. So. Mm-hmm. Yep. That's correct. Mm-hmm. And yeah, until you issue a commit, which, by the way, issues a begin, so that you'll always be in a transaction. The whole concept is to sort of safeguard yourself and always be in a transaction. It's popular under Oracle because people are always trying to fix Oracle, and they're in SQL Plus, and they're fiddle-assing around, and they make a mistake, and they've lost everything. So from memory, SQL Plus actually ships with their equivalent of auto-commit to be off, so that the second you actually enter into a session with the database, the first query that you execute opens up a transaction, and all subsequent work is embedded within that transaction. Yes, commit rollback. In fact, if you issue a commit and there has actually been an error, meaning that you cannot possibly commit, it will automatically rollback for you. And we, of course, implement rollback as well, which takes you back to the original point. Databases like Oracle and SQL 99 provide for things like nested transactions and save points. Nested transactions and save points are really another burning issue for Postgres, at least in my opinion, because for extremely complicated queries where you anticipate the possibility of an error, it's remarkably useful to be able to, instead of roll all the way back to the beginning, you might be running a query which takes, say, 2 minutes to execute, you can just go back to the previous save point or the higher level transaction. Very, very, very useful. Unfortunately, Postgres won't have it until maybe 7 months from now. Oh, yes, yeah. But not nested. So you would have to type begin, blah, 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 commit, begin, blah, 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 commit. Oh, yeah, definitely. That's what I'll be looking at in a second. That's one of the big sellers for Postgres. Like, for a long time, it was just Postgres and the other real big enterprise databases, which had this multi-version concurrency system. I'll just have a look at transaction isolation first, and then really jump into multi-version concurrency control. Okay. Maybe I've understood. I misunderstood. Sorry. What? Oh no. Sorry. Was that your question? Sorry. I thought you meant two simultaneous connections running transactions. Of course, it does that. Sorry. No, you can't have. The problem is that it would simply. It would require a lot of coding. It could be done. It would require a lot of coding, and it would require things like save points. But it would be for no gain when the user can simply open up a simultaneous connection within their application. So no, sorry, you can't do that.
What you can do is have multiple queries simultaneously on the same connection.
No, you can't. No.
I can issue one query and do fetch right, and in the middle of the effect I would issue another query.
Ah, sorry, that would be because the first query has actually finished. Later in the talk, I'll show you a situation where you'll completely screw up your application if you do that, namely using non-blocking I/O. When you're using the standard, shall I say, library to access Postgres, either the C library or say the Perl stuff or whatever, most people are using, unless they otherwise explicitly said it, non-blocking I/O. Blocking I/O. This means that when you actually issue your command to execute a query, irrespective of what programming language you're using, say you're using C or PHP or Perl or whatever language people are using with Postgres, it will actually block at that point and wait until the query comes back in its entirety. So all the data has been sent back from the application, irrespective of whether it's 1 byte or 300 megabyte, and then you can keep on going. So yes, the fact that you can access, say, just the first line or the first tuple returned and then issue another query, it simply shows the fact that that data is actually coming back from the database and actually living in a buffer in the client-side C language library, as opposed to actually staying on the server.
So the client will have a 300-meg buffer?
Yes, that's correct. That's why it appears to work. That buffer won't be entirely memory resident from memory. I can't remember. I can go over that in the BOF. Obviously, if you had 300 megabyte worth of stuff and you're running it just on some crappy Windows PC or something like that, you're in trouble. That's why I think it actually backs into temp space. But I've never thought about that one. So yeah. But does that answer your question?
Yes. I do that, and I know that it works.
Yes. Yeah. It works because all the data has actually come back, even though you haven't retrieved it all. When you issue your PQ get val value or your Perl equivalent or your PHP equivalent or your whatever language, that is actually retrieving it just from a dynamic data structure held in the C language library, not from the database itself. So you could, for example, PQ finish that connection and still get the data. Do you understand what I mean? Like the connection would actually be closed, and you can still service. Yeah, you can pull the Ethernet cable out, it's sorted. Okay. I don't mind questions about MySQL. I don't actually know very much about MySQL. But yes, it does support transactions. It supports them through a storage manager called InnoDB, spelled INNODB, which was developed by, I think it was a friend of Monty, who, if you know anything about MySQL, you would know of. The problem that I have with it is this. MySQL, and I've got no like personal feelings of hatred or whatever for MySQL. I just don't think it's a very good database, which is fair enough. They have a concept, and those of you who have used, how many people have used MySQL? Okay, excellent. How many people, like, still use it, they're just here to see, wait for me to trip up or something like that. They just... Excellent. You see, usually David Axmark, who is like the CTO of MySQL AB, usually he's in my talks. He has like, I'm not joking, like I'll be in, I don't know, San Diego, and I'll be going, oh, listen guys, like just quietly. MySQL's pretty shit. And David will stand up. David, it'd have to be, Gavin, I told you last night that... The thickest Swedish accent you've ever heard. But well, they're all great guys. But sorry, getting back to the question. Yes, it does support transactions. It supports them using the InnoDB, what I would call storage manager. I don't think that they call it that. What does MySQL call that handle or plugin for? Sure, okay, the table backend. It supports another three or four from memory. It supports the one that Monty originally wrote. It plugs into Berkeley DB or SleepyCat and possibly a few others. You're in serious trouble if your database has any other types of tables in them. That is, tables which are not do not have the InnoDB transaction manager. This completely invalidates their point that it's an excellent feature, in my opinion. Why? Because if having multiple storage managers is such a useful thing, how come when you get to one of the most useful aspects of an SQL relational database, transactions, how come we can't make use of the database properly? If you have two types of tables, say one is the MyISAM, is it called, or something like that, MyISAM storage manager, and the other one is InnoDB, you issue a begin, or however you begin a transaction, you then insert say some credit card details into your InnoDB table. You then reduce some product count or something like that in your other database, which is stored in a different transaction in another table. Sorry, which is stored in a different with a different storage manager. There's a problem because maybe that product doesn't exist or whatever. Something goes wrong, and you roll back. The actual operation on the tables or table, which is not in ODB, does not get rolled back. That data stays in there because it doesn't support transactions. This for me is a bleeding critical, am I not wrong there? Well, the obvious point is just run everything through in ODB. If you need transactions or you know, if... So, sorry, I've lost you there. Yeah. Sure. Oracle connection handling is way more sophisticated or difficult, depending on how you look at it, than Postgres. Yes. But my argument was a little more complicated than that. I essentially said that they can't say that this multiple storage managers is good and yet screw up some of their users, because surely any of their users who want to use transactions will. I mean, I can't see a situation where they would use anything but the InnoDB tables. It's an academic point. Yeah. Oh, like they. I'm sure they would. Sure. That's a valid point. In fact, it actually brings out one of the, not flaws, but it actually really draws out the nature of Postgres and, say, Oracle and IBM DB2 and all that stuff. What I'm about to talk about with the multi-version concurrency control system really, really adds performance problems under certain situations, which I'll detail. The problem is that there's a balancing act when it comes to relational databases. If you want a shit-hot database, use SleepyCat DB. Not just because it's fast, It has nested transactions. It has replication. It plugs into things like Tuxedo. It's a damn good database. It's bloody fast. It's also bloody hard to use, really hard to debug, and it requires expensive, well-trained C programmers who want to sit around all day and just look at the code and drink lattes or whatever. People like me. So the actual cost of development with a database like that is much higher. The cost of development with something, say, like MySQL, excluding, say, MySQL a year ago or whenever it didn't have InnoDB, should be comparatively much lower, all things being equal, because you don't have to worry about things like rolling back transactions. That decreases a layer of complexity within your transaction. And you're essentially just throwing things at a database and pulling them back out again. Whereas with Berkeley DB, there's a huge can of worms that you're opening. So, yeah, that's the choice that you make. That should, I hope, show that the choice of database software is always a balancing act between features on the one hand and performance on the other. And I always recommend people to use Berkeley DB if they're strictly interested in performance. It is damn fast. Were there any other questions before I talk more about this concept of multi-versioning and all that sort of stuff? Okay. The other thing about transactions is that given the fact that they're all about isolation of users and encapsulation of work, you can isolate transactions in two discrete ways under Postgres. SQL 92 and 99 support four different ways. The two different ways that Postgres support are read commit isolation level and serializable isolation level. From memory, actually, I think MySQL in ODB only supports serializable. I can't remember. It certainly is the default. Read commit works like this, and I really wish I had a marker. Say you have two transactions, transaction number one, transaction number two. They open up transactions, they issue their begins, they do some stuff. Transaction number one is reading a table, we'll just call it test, and getting the data out of it. Transaction number two is updating the table called test, issuing inserts or updates or deletes. Transaction number two then commits. Transaction number one rereads the table called test. It is now different. If it has been manipulated by transaction two. This is actually a desirable feature under most circumstances in SQL. The serializable transaction isolation level means literally that. The transactions behave as if they are serialized, as if they had occurred not concurrently, but one after the other based on when they began operating. The other two is read-only. That would also be useful and it's being worked on for 7.2. That's SQL 99. SQL 92 has two others. Read uncommit. Read uncommit reads everything. If you are retrieving information from a table which someone has inserted data into, you will see it irrespective of the state of their transaction. If they then roll back, you've got dummy data. The only real application I can think of it for is debugging purposes and monitoring and so on. The other transaction isolation level is read repeatable, which means that each time you read the table, it will be identical to the last time you read it, which is what most people think it means. SQL 99 introduces read-only and read-write and write or something like that. I can't quite remember. But that's transaction isolation. All of this is supported by the multi-version concurrency control system in Postgres. What is multi-versioning? Anyone familiar with CVS knows basically what multi-versioning is. That is, more than one person at any one time can work concurrently on the same snapshot of data or text or information and then independently merge that back into the database itself. How does Postgres do this? When a table is manipulated, as opposed to when something is retrieved from it, when a table is manipulated, insert, delete, update, a new instance of the tuple which is updated, deleted, inserted, is inserted. The old one is not removed. And it stays, for other transactions, active until the user manipulating the table commits. Once they've committed, what actually happens is that the old tuple is invalidated and it's marked that it's been superseded. This means that you get an effect like such. These are just tuples or tables on disk themselves. There's old tuple data in there taking up space on the hard disk, which needs to be reread every time you retrieve the information from disk, but it's not useful. It will be discarded by every single transaction. So that's the cost of having this concurrent transaction kind of framework. It's a big problem for people really looking at performance with Postgres, because say for example you have what here 10 tuples. If you delete all of those and insert 10 new ones, then you'll have actually 20 tuples on disk. Imagine your table has 1 million tuples. You delete them all and replace them. You now have effectively two times more data to scan through in a sequential scan situation, and you also have bloat within your B-tree or hash algorithm if you're using indices. I'll definitely be covering that. InnoDB, just going back to it, again, I know essentially nothing about MySQL. InnoDB does not have this problem. The reason why Postgres has this, say, problem is that the original design did not consider it to be a problem. Again, we're coming back to the fact, a balancing act again. It is rare that you have a million tuple table which you then delete everything from and replace, or you update every single row in that. Usually the ratio of tuples, dead tuples to otherwise active tuples, is quite low. There are, of course, exceptions, but generally speaking, when it comes to database work, you're way more often retrieving information from the database than updating it. There are applications which don't do that, but perhaps they should use a database more designed for it. Generally speaking, as well, applications which are doing manipulating the data very, very intensely are usually single-user database applications, as well, their data mining application or something like that. This means that Postgres is not good for that kind of situation. Perhaps if you need an SQL or interface, MySQL would be another option. Firebird would be another option. BerkeleyDB is not really an option for things like data mining and ad hoc query analysis, because it's simply so hard to provide an interface for it, compared with just opening up an SQL terminal and issuing a select query. Nonetheless, Postgres is pretty much stuck with this kind of multi-version concurrency system. But that's not a bad thing. It is a very, very good multi-version concurrency system, and it guarantees that your data can be rolled back and that it is isolated. There are ways to manipulate that, and I'll go into more detail about vacuuming tuples a little later on. But any of you familiar with Postgres will know that in order to shrink applications, in order to shrink tables, that is, pull out all the dead tuples, you need to issue a vacuum command. The manual itself recommends vacuuming nightly for high use databases. There has been work done on an auto vacuum daemon to run. The reason why there isn't one built into the back end is exactly because of this reason of multi-versioning, except for the special case of vacuum, no transaction can see data which the backend hasn't determined that it should see, if you understand what I mean. That is, it will not see these expired items. Vacuum is a special case. It's the only one which sees every single tuple. So if this tuple number one here had been deleted 5 times, when vacuum retrieves the information from disk, it actually sees 5 versions. It removes the 4 that are dead. Oh, you can definitely do it online. There is essentially no operation, not essentially, there is no SQL level operation under Postgres which requires the database to be taken offline. Mind you, 7.1 and prior databases where you issued a vacuum just a standard vacuum analyze, I'll go into that later on, would essentially halt the data, not halt, but slow the database down greatly. Because it's a very, very disk intensive operation. You're reading every single page on disk. If you've got a 5 gigabyte database, you have to read that 5 gigabyte and then move 8 kilobyte slots of it around a lot, and then move like 50 byte slots of it around a lot, then reread it a few times. So you do not need to take it offline. Issuing standard vacuum under 7.2 and 7.3 does not use exclusive locking on the table, which is what a lot of that problem was. Sorry, this is what I was getting to. The auto vacuum daemon is being developed by, I think it's a guy in India, and it will essentially keep statistics on how regularly a table is updated, and based on that, issue a vacuum of that table. So if every 5 minutes you are deleting everything from one particular table and then reinserting it again, well, first of all, your application's broken. But secondly, it will actually record that information, and instead of updating the big, huge 1 gigabyte size table, which is static, never even gets touched by an insert, update, or delete, instead of vacuuming that, which might take 20 minutes, it only vacuums the really small table, which has only 20 rows or something in it. Anyone else? The locking is tolerably intelligent. When you have, say, serializable transaction level, isolation level, Postgres has about 5 or 6 types of locks. So when you go to retrieve a tuple, you also need to see whether or not you can update it. Do you understand what I mean? At a read commit level, it doesn't essentially doesn't matter, but at serializable level, if someone has updated a table, changed what's in it, and then you want to update it, you've got to block until you see whether or not the transaction is going to be committed or not. Otherwise, you're going to update data which you don't think is there. Yes, depending on what you actually do to the table, depends how intensively it's locked. If you read a table, if two transactions are simultaneously reading a table, there's no need for locks, because they're not updating. If one transaction updates a table, say deletes all the tuples, and another transaction comes along at read commit level and selects everything from it, it selects it, it's fine. If, for example, a transaction instead issues select blah, 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 for update, it actually locks that table, effectively locks that table. When it locks it in shared memory, it doesn't do anything on disk. And the transaction which is waiting on that other transaction to finish to see whether or not it actually commits it, in which case So there might be nothing left in the table, in which case there's no reason why the second transaction would need to read it. The second transaction will block, waiting for the first one to do it because it needs the lock. Locking under at other levels of Postgres is usually quite granular. That is, most commands which say manipulate data, such as cluster, which I'll detail later on, do use granular locking. That is, they don't just lock the whole bloody thing. They lock it for, say, a particular type of particular type of retrieval. Select, update, insert, and so on. At the BOF, if people are interested, I can actually go through the C code for that. But your first presumption was essentially correct. If two transactions are running simultaneously, the first transaction, which began first, is removing all the data from the table. The second transaction can't logically do something based on that, so it must block. And that's essentially locked. So there's not a locking concept there. Do you understand what I mean? Like, it's sort of like, I cannot access this yet, as opposed to locking. We don't tend to... I make the distinction because locks aren't used as widely as that suggests. Like, it sounds academic, but if any of the Postgres guys were here and I said, yes, it locked it, they would jump all over me and Tom would kick me and Bruce would smile at me funny and stuff. Bruce is a really nice guy, if you ever meet him. Very religious, but really, really nice guy. Tom is a great guy as well. Tom really knows his stuff, if you've ever read the Hacker's List. If you ever want to be inspired to program, you've got to check this guy out. He's unbelievable. Like, this guy commits stuff which just touches every aspect of the code, and it's like, oh, I just thought I had a bit of time before I had a cup of tea. He is unbelievable. And he scrutinizes patches. You can't get anything in. Like, there's always some issue that, like, he envisages taking place in 10 years' time. He tests code. Like, he is the most anal tester of code you've ever come across. He will test 10 lines of code all day long because he has a well-educated hunch that there's a problem with it. Anytime there's a bad bug, Tom nails it. Tom, therefore, unfortunately, essentially holds up the very, very technical side of Postgres. Neil will probably take over in about 5 years' time. That's if you care about the background there. But TGL at postgresql.com.org, Tom Lane, oh, unbelievable programmer. Anyway. So did anyone have any more questions about... Mm-hmm. Yeah. No. That would be one optimization. From memory. Well, vacuum shrinks it. Vacuum does all the tuples at once. Yes. I wasn't going to go into that level of detail. But yes, that's correct. I'll be talking in a second about how that essentially works. But what was your exact question again? Do they get reused? Yes. When you mark them expired like that, that's what happens. But there are issues with that, particularly when it comes to B-trees. And you under Postgres, unfortunately, we have this bloat concept because B-tree pages are only two-thirds full. So over time, you get these absolutely huge B-trees for very, very intensely updated indexes. But that's maybe a little too technical, but I will go into it later on a little. Sorry, you're going to have to repeat.
One of the features of PostgreSQL, which I've seen reported, is that it can, you have the ability to see not only what value of pieces of data has now, but what it had in previous.
That was the case about 6 years ago.
That's no longer the case.
Being completely ripped out, along with all the other Lisp code. There is some argument for it to be brought back in, but that doesn't matter because Neil Conway is working on point-in-time recovery, which allows you to roll the database back or forward to any discrete moment in time. So you will have that, but you'll be able to service that at the Unix command line level as opposed to at the SQL level where it's more computationally intensive. So you will have that functionality. It's a bit of functionality which someone always brings up at a conference. What happened to time travel? But like it was ripped out years ago. Yes. So unfortunately, yeah, that doesn't exist anymore. That was even before we had multi-version concurrency control. Sorry? Yes. Yes. Okay. were there any other questions? At CVS level, of course. Although I believe I went looking for the time travel code and it wasn't in CVS. It should be. How long ago was it that you heard this feature lauded about? Either the person was mistaken, who told you or whatever.
No, I remember reading it somewhere, but maybe I read it on an old document.
It must have been an old document. Like, I don't even think it was in, like, Postgres 95. Time travel, yes, it comes up every now and then. You will have the industry standard or enterprise time travel in point-in-time recovery. It will be in 7.4. It currently works. It's just not pretty. There you go. It wasn't as old as I thought. I couldn't find it in CBS, but if you want to go dig through... Oh, forget. Any other questions about anything Postgres? Yes. Yes. Please roll my database forward 10 years. Yeah. To do way less work. Any more? I'm happy to go over this in way more detail. I was speaking to a guy beforehand who wanted to know about everything replication. This is another thing that I talk about and try to work on and stuff like that. Yes, enterprise features are like what I try to focus on, at least when I sit around the pub talking to people, because enterprise features are also very hard to write. Point-in-time recovery, we'll get in 7.4. As far as I know, the patch is pretty much stabilised and it's being worked on by Patrick McDonald at Red Hat with Neil Conway in Toronto. I'll just finish this other query about enterprise features. Multi-master, multi to slave, partial replication and offline replication are being worked on intensely by Darren Johnson in California, and by a woman who's been working on it since about 1995 with her students. She's a professor of computer science in Geneva, I think it is. She actually came up with the original concept, which is being used by the replication guys. Master to single, or is it multi-master? One level of replication has been finished off for the 7.2 code. It was previously running on 6.5.3, which is significantly different from this. It was terrible code, mostly written by third year computer science honors students, commented entirely in languages other than English. But Darren Johnson, for about the last maybe 1.5-2 years, has been working on replication, so that will be a very, very, very big one to get into Postgres. Like, that will solve 95% of my problems with Postgres.
So,
Okay. The version that Darren has got into 7.2 is presumably single phase, as opposed to Oracle style two-phase commit. Single phase master to slave replication, but run out of the post out of Postgres itself, not run by like some sort of third-party SQL level tool, of which there are several. He's also working on all other, shall we say, recognized types of replication. That includes multi-master replication, probably the most desirable. Postgres, partial replication, let's just replicate one table. Semi-offline, I think it's called, replication, which is sort of like, let's replicate every half hour, as opposed to, let's not return to the user before we say we're replicated, and two-phase commit replication, which is sort of like, which is the most logical way to replicate something in a multi-master environment, namely, the server which gets the query, sends the query to all the other servers in the cluster, says, you run it, I'll run it, let me know how you go, everyone's sweet, excellent, I'll commit, you all commit, we're done. That's why it's called two-phase commit. The first stage is like, is everyone ready to commit? Yes, that is, no error was encountered on any machine. Okay, let's all quit. Oh, let's all commit. Done. Two-phase commit is slow for intensive updates for that reason. There's a bunch of traffic, how are you, my day's good, all this kind of crap going on. Meanwhile, the application's sitting there, they can't read their email or whatever. Single-phase commit is using a spread protocol. Essentially, all the data is broadcast, and there's some little networking tricks which are being used to ensure that everyone gets it properly. And basically, if databases don't get something properly and don't update, there must be a critical problem, takes itself offline. Can be brought back online, full replication of the data to the current point, all that sort of thing. But unless we have time at the end, this is probably not the best place. First of all, because even though Darren promises it to be ready by like May, it's not going to happen. Because I've read the code, and there's lots of stuff like, are we an insert transaction? String end comp, insert, first six letters of the query, stuff like that. Like, that's not elegant code, so there's just no way Tom will let it in with stuff like that in it. It won't be fast enough. Sorry, go. Sorry, I missed the first part of it.
Explain to me the length from the last table.
Uh-huh.
If the data that is returned, according to the set of the data that is counted, exactly from the time that the read that the select started, regardless of the transactions which may be happening and being committed during the time that the...
Yes. The database itself, one of the major jobs it does is saying, is this the most current version for you? Which might actually be a very old version if you've got a long-running transaction, but it guarantees that it gets its own unique snapshot. That is what multi-version concurrency control does. Sorry, before your arm falls off. Haven't heard anything about it, and I haven't really done very much with LDAP, but surely it's like an LDAP, isn't it? Wouldn't it? Okay. Mm-hmm. How much do you know about LDAP? You just got yourself a job. Hey, it's open source. Jump in. If you know C, sort it out, because I don't know that. And actually, this is a problem with Postgres, is actually, I was talking to Neil Conway the other day. Neil had a problem. He had to write a search engine, a full-text indexing search engine for a company which looked up domain names, and it was slow. I said, I've done this before, welcome to real life, use Berkeley DB. And he made the funniest comment, especially for a guy his age, that I've ever heard. He said, I said, so why are you doing this? Usually he like ignores his university studies or school studies or wherever he's at and just works on Postgres sort of like, you know, 150 hours a week. And he said, oh, I'm just doing some, you know, database work for this guy. I've got to make some money. I'm poor. You know, I look funny and all sorts of stuff. And I said, you know, that pays the bills. He said, no, it's excellent in open source to get down from the ivory tower every now and then. Talk about insightful. This is the problem. Like, people like Tom Lane or Bruce Mongin, not that there's anything wrong with them, they probably haven't written a database application in 5 years. This is why the excellent features, and including point-in-time recovery, which was given to us in July, a guy out of the blue who could barely speak English sent in an email in terrible grammar, not as bad as most Americans, but in terrible grammar for someone who did a degree in English literature, saying, oh, I need higher level of reliability with my database, here's point in time recovery. Now, because of that bad, this is hard stuff. Like, there is black magic involved. Like, anyone who's worked on a project which has, you know, 500,000-600,000 lines of C code, does lots of complicated things, might break a lot of people's stuff, particularly when it has to do with something like write-ahead logging, which I'll go into in a little while. Particularly with something like write-ahead logging, which is designed to guarantee the persistence of someone's data, possibly the most important aspect of a database, possibly. For someone just to come out of the blue and go, oh, here's 100,000 lines of code. But yeah, that's what's great about that. Yeah, I was just about to look at the time. Ah, excellent. Okay, I think we've done transactions to death. Does anyone not agree? We only talked about them for an hour. But they're important. Okay, right ahead logging. I'm going to attempt to speed things up because I'm only 1/4 of the way through. And this is the easy half. This is the easy quarter. Okay, write-ahead logging. Is there anyone who doesn't know what write-ahead logging is? Okay then, I'll definitely talk about it. Write-ahead logging is simply a journaling technique or mechanism. You, instead of directly updating or removing data from the actual stuff on the actual heap, tuples on disk, you write it to a log instead, which is then can be played back in case of critical failure. And there we have several mechanisms. Most importantly, a CRC per page and a CRC per entry. Is it? Where's Chris? Is that right? Chris is gone. Has he? I know. Oh, yes. Anyway, there's several mechanisms which we use to guarantee the persistence of the data through a write-ahead log, which is much, much more difficult to do at the heap level. That is the level of the actual physical table on disk. So it's just like a journaling file system. It's just like any other mechanism which uses that kind of playback log. This means that if your server gets reset, power fails, there's a hardware issue, whatever, you should be able to avoid hardware corruption. Obviously, if you have a hard disk problem, you can't avoid hardware corruption. If you have a memory problem, which affects your actual writing to log, like if you've got a memory problem, you've got serious problems anyway. People actually have memory problems way more than they think that they do. You'll remember my problem on the other day. People have memory problems much more often than they think, and this is why there's things like the SIG11 factor and all that sort of stuff. But if you have a memory problem and for some strange reason it only comes into effect at the time that you're writing your while log entry before your machine halts or something like that, that CRC entry in the while log will save you from entering invalid data into your database. The problem with WAL is that in order to use it as a method for guaranteeing the persistence of data, it needs to be fsynced to disk. Fsync is expensive. Just writing stuff to using write is not expensive because it gets buffered. It stays in memory until certain conditions are met, and then it's actually flushed to disk. Fsync means flush it right now, and this has to happen for every single WAL log entry. That is damn expensive. But again, as a balancing act between features and performance, a database is completely useless if it cannot guarantee the persistence of its data. It's only a little useless if it's bloody slow. Of course, it's worse. It can't possibly buy you anything because you're journaling two times. No, you can't turn WAL off. That's correct. There is some research done into this back in 2001. The problem, of course, with databases, as well as things like operating system stuff, every type of benchmark is hotly contested. But the problem is, for bloody good reasons. Do you know what I mean? Like, when you provide a benchmark, it's rare that people just go, yep, that benchmark's correct, our database is crap, and yours is excellent. Or our file system is crap, or our operating system is crap. And what many people take to be just, you know, fervor for what one has done oneself, and there's plenty of that in there, there is some residing logic. It's like, Red Hat, I think it was Patrick McDonald, did a study into the performance of Postgres on different file systems. It did Extended 2, Extended 3, XFS, and some modified, like privately modified versions of EXC2 to try to rip out some of the, you know, expensive aspects of it, and we got varying results. Some tests showed that Postgres was bloody fast on a Jodl file system, and some tests said that, as one would expect, it was bloody slow, like about 15% slower, I think we concluded in the end, for XFS over EXC2. But one can simply then go, I don't run a Linux box. Fair enough. We can't penalise you or not think about you. In fact, Tom Lane uses HPUX, why I don't know, and Bruce Momshin uses BSDOS. Like, Tom works for Red Hat, you know, rarely uses Linux. Bruce works for a company which mainly deploys AIX and uses BSDOS. Most of the other developers use Linux, I think. Most of the other major developers use Linux or BSD. All the BSD guys, whenever this whole journaling file system thing comes up and goes, well, we just use UFS, which is a more, well, comparatively speaking, a lighter weight file system, BSD users would argue, than EXT2. Is that correct, Greg?
No,
it's not. Okay, I'm going to take... So, again...
We've done a lot of stuff in the past, and we've been talking about that there, and we're going to be doing the
Yeah.
And the result is, I think that if you talk about pure performance, lightweight and all that, we get to do it. But I can turn this machine off here now, and...
Yeah. So again, it's a balancing mechanism. If you say, for example, don't trust the Postgres developers a lot, and I mean, you could really trust some people like Tom and Bruce because they're sober, upstanding citizens. People like me and other fringe developers, shall I say, we're drunks and stuff like that. So most of our code isn't really that good. So in that case, and if you had extremely important data, fast disk, it wasn't a problem for you, you would use a journaling file system on top of a journaling application just to have just to reduce the possibility of a single point of failure. If, like most people, you just wanted to get as much performance as possible, you would attempt to use a file system which does not journal, or a journaling file system with soft updates and all that sort of stuff. I haven't actually looked into it too far, but yeah.
Journaling file system will make your everything cheaper.
Theoretically, yes, and that's why we. Yes, that's right. Yes, and there was plenty of other tests, and I'll go into it, using different syncing methodologies like OpenSync and all that sort of stuff. The results are up there. Unfortunately, they're a bit old. Those who know more about file systems than me, and actually it comes, database developers often make bad file system developers and vice versa, which is interesting, but that's why Postgres 1 doesn't have a file system style layout, and it's secondly why some of these things are hotly contested, because the two don't know enough about each other. And also, so the third point is that database activity is wildly unpredictable. You know, it's very, very hard to plan for. No, it doesn't. And I dare say it's going to be a very, very cold day when it does. Mostly because a lot of the people who would have the expertise to do it have had experience with Oracle and at the same time are quite good or have had experience as sysadmins working with Oracle DBAs. I don't know how many of you have done so, but Oracle DBAs have this notorious ability to not understand, like I just said before, the amount that the application is going to have to scale to, so make the table space too small, and you've got serious problems then. Unbreakable. It's not so bad, but again, plugging into those sorts of things is another layer of complexity, and again, I think it was Tom Lane said that he hadn't been provided with any information that suggested that, contrary to common sense, that there was any performance gain to be had.
I work with top end Oracle systems, and the general sense at the moment is that the reverse means nobody does Oracle or Oracle by efficiency, they can avoid it.
Yeah,
and
that's what I thought.
It's not worth fighting for, considering the enormous difficulty in managing the system.
Oh, yeah, this is what I was trying to give an indication of. It can be a real ask, yeah.
Not worth it. But one comment that I would like to make based on my general, I think the problem will be the same on top Oracle systems, is that once you start going up with load, because of the cost of testing that is unavoidable,
and it has to.
It has to. And use a small sequential write of 2 kilobytes or so. Then, if you don't have there one disk, it will saturate. Right? It will saturate because no, even 15,000 RPM disk will maximum 200 PCI per second.
Sure.
So it gets 200 PCI per second and that's it. And for this, there is a solution. The solution is trivial. You simply buy an array, you put that on an array that is that has memory backed up buffer backed up
And
then your IO rate goes to about, depending on how good is your array, but you may get 2,000, you may get 5,000
IOs per
second. Like 5,000 IOs per second to your write ahead log requires about 16 to 30 CPUs.
Sure. Oh, look, don't get me wrong. I've worked on scary Oracle systems as well, fully decked E10Ks with 10 to 15 terabyte of EMC disk, 9 RAID controllers, always 2 gig cache each. We had a system, and the EMC disk array was actually could feed more data into the E10K than the E10K could handle with 64 CPUs and 288 gigabyte of RAM. It was a big array, and it ran a 7 terabyte Oracle database. But your problem is correct. Mind you, that system was valued at $25 million. And it took three sudden admins working three shifts a day, all brought out from the US. Each in case is seriously expensive, $2 million in Oracle licensing per year, 40 gig of memory on site, Sun contracts, you know, it's seriously expensive. Oh, definitely. Yep. Not strictly. This is a shortcoming of Postgres as well, and I referred to it earlier only in passing. But something that say I, Bruce, Neil, and some of the other guys want to work on is the ability to select discrete locations to actually place different data aspects of the system itself. Put WAL on this super fast, 15K RPM system. Whereas you put some table which is rarely used on some old, though still reliable, disk. This is much more logical, and increasingly systems have multi-channel RAID, fiber channel RAID or something like that. Even at what we would call comparatively low-end situations. Postgres cannot do this. In fact, people use some symbolic links to do it manually. This is unreliable, and I wouldn't recommend doing it. Mind you, I have one client who actually does it because they have a serious disk, including a solid state disk, which I can't really take advantage of because I can't do this with Postgres. It is marked, what has been marked, important item on the to-do list for about a year, but I'm pretty sure that Bruce has freed up enough time. Neil has a sophisticated enough understanding. I might be able to get some time on hands to bring this in, but it's 50,000 lines of code, and we have to dramatically overhaul the planner because of the possibility that, and not possibility, the fact that given this idea of putting things on different disks and assuming that you will get better performance, we'll have to modify the planner costing model to say this disk is fast, therefore my random page cost is lower. And therefore the planner should think that certain queries which would traditionally be very expensive because we're assuming that the disk is slow, we're going to have to sequentially read it, we only get 200 IOs per second, whatever, we're going to have to change that model because of the possibility of striping all this data across multiple disk arrays. That's hard. The actual bit of going create table blah 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 with location equals / temp, That's not very hard. That's almost just syntactical sugar.
Do you think that this is actually your problem for something else? This is rather the problem of placing the load on the correct IO.
Yes, but currently we don't. We give people in stock standard, like vanilla installations, only one option, where to place the data directory. And we can only place it all together.
Right.
Do you understand what I mean? No, you can with symlinks, but is that something that you really want to do? You want to have a good understanding of what this completely numerically based... Whoa. Okay, sorry. Okay then. Sweet. Okay. So, we move on. The storage situation. I'll cover this very quickly because it's boring. Data is stored in pages and they are simply sequentially placed on disk. That's in terms of your raw table. And the actual page structure itself looks something like this. We have a little bit of magic in the page header and then we just have the location of actual tuples which we're interested in. Not asking questions, am I? Access methods. We have just a quick example of what an index looks like. We go through the B-tree. The B-tree itself, as an index, doesn't store all the data. It simply stores the location That is the block and page offset of the tuple itself. The database then goes and gets that from the heap itself, as opposed to storing it in the in the index. A sequential scan, which I'll speak about later, simply reads the data as it says from start to end. Joining tables. Someone referred to this beforehand. We can join tables in three different ways. You'll see this once you start debugging your queries, or when you have debugged your queries, you would have seen this. The three ways are, first of all, a hash join. With a hash join, you have a sorted list on your left-hand side. Your right-hand side is stored in a hash. We simply dig into the hash for each instance on the left-hand side. Pretty simple method, but it can be expensive. A merge join requires two sorted sets of data, left-hand side, right-hand side, where you're actually joining your tables. Left-hand side, right-hand side, you simply read them simultaneously and join them in that way. Because they're sorted, you can continue to read until you find an instance on the right-hand side which matches. The nested loop is the computationally most expensive merge situation for most situations, because we have to try each instance on the right-hand side for every instance on the left-hand side. So you have a permutations issue. For small data sets on the left-hand side, right-hand side, or both, this can be cheap, because we don't have to do things like hash large amounts of data or anything, or do large sorts, which might back into disk. So for very small situations, this can be a benefit. Query planning. I might jump over this unless someone really wants to know about exactly what happens inside the planner. Is anyone curious about the costing model in the planner at all? Sure. I will make one point about this, because people ask me often. Postgres is not licensed under GPL, it's licensed under a Berkeley-style license. About once a month there's a request for this to change. I'm not sure why, because it's really not that simple. And besides that, most of the people who have put in the vast majority of the work into Postgres really like the Berkeley-style license. Runtime configuration I'll run through quickly as well. Boolean values are, there's a variety of Boolean values which are accepted. There are other types of values and they're specific. I'll deal with them as we come to them. Memory related for performance reasons. Shared buffers will probably do the most for you in terms of increasing performance without having to modify your application. Shared buffers is simply the amount of shared memory to allocate to caching in 8 kilobyte blocks. While buffers simply refers to the number of blocks in memory which will back into the while system for caching purposes. Thought mem again can have a big performance impact, because it allows you to avoid, in trivial situations, backing onto disk. Imagine, for example, a two-way join of a couple of tables. They're both, say, 5 megabyte in size. The resulting join is at least 10 megabyte in size, not including any of the effects of the data structure itself, which means that we have to hit disk, say, for something that big, where we use a tape sorting system in order to join things on disk itself. That's much, much, much more expensive than doing it in memory. So if you have a lot of RAM, you can increase the performance of selects, particularly if you have very large ones, by increasing sort mem. Vacuum mem can have the same effect by, again, avoiding having to hit disk. We spoke before about free space in the situation where you had expired tuples and you run a vacuum. The MaxFSM relations and MaxFSM pages allow you to manipulate how much memory is dedicated to keeping track of free space within relations. It works on a uses a method which attempts to assess the most used relations, thereby keeping track of free space within them. If you have a lot of tables which are very large, that is, they have more large pages, you will not be keeping track of their free space. Therefore, they will grow out and you won't reuse those. So people with large installations should really look at the effects of manipulating those. I've also provided some numbers as to how large they can grow, how much memory they can consume. Okay, performance relating to disk. Checkpoint timeout will determine how long in seconds it takes before the while log is checkpointed, which again requires more async tolerance and stuff. Commit delay and commit siblings is actually an intelligent way of handling a situation where you have lots of transactions running concurrently and you believe that they might be all committing at the same time. Therefore, you can write all the data, all the while entries to the while log and fsync. It's just a way of reducing the number of fsyncs that you need to do. Commit delay is a number in microseconds that you will wait for some pending transactions to commit. And commit siblings is the minimum number of concurrently running transactions before you actually do a select, that is, a select on file descriptors. Does anyone have an issue with that? Because it can be very useful under very high concurrent situations. Okay. You can also change the sync method from fsync to other supported sync routines. They, of course, depend on whether or not your kernel implements them. But, for example, fdatasync only syncs data. It doesn't update metadata, like access times and so on. OpenSync is a different algorithm, and it escapes me how it's different. I can't quite remember, but your operating system documentation will detail how it's different from fsync and OpenDataSync and so on. You can, of course, turn fsync off by setting fsync equals false or fsync equals off, probably a bad idea for production databases. We have some optimizer-related variables. These have to do really with the costing model. They're reasonably complicated. I'm going to skip over them unless someone really wants to hear about them. Logging got much better under 7.3. We can now determine the level of debugging information which is written to the server side and to the client side. We can also determine what queries are... we can also determine when a query should be written to the log for debugging purposes. Say a query generates a notice or an error. Previously, it was very hard to determine from the log what caused that error. Now we can say, if logmin error statement equals, error, that is, the query failed for some particular reason, we can actually log that query and tell the administrator or developer that that query generated an error. Very useful for debugging purposes. We can also plug into syslog. Again, you can configure auto commit from inside the server configuration. You can also configure it within a single session. Australian time zones are a special case as well, as anyone who's worked with Australian time zones will know, because of the differences in daylight saving. Search path allows us to determine what our schema search path is going to be at the configuration level. We might want to impose a schema search path such that all connections first look in some special pseudo schema which the administrator or key developer or something has determined. By default, it's set to $user, public, so that it goes first to the user schema, then to the public schema. Authentication. This is the most basic authentication. We have several columns. I think there's six. The first determines what how the user will be connecting, what databases they'll be connecting to, which user. We can you can specify a Postgres username, the IP address which they're connecting from, an alternate IP mask, and how to allow them to authenticate. Trust means they don't need to provide a password. You can write PAM, which means it'll use a PAM module to authenticate them. Kerberos, several other methods are supported, though not LDAP from them. Sorry? Oh, sorry, yes, of course, PAM LDAP will work, but I don't think there's a native support for LDAP. SQL standards compliance. There are two SQL standards. The third one's being written on, from memory. Postgres implements most of SQL 92 and much of SQL 99. In fact, some people are saying that it supports, it's the most standards compliant database. I'm really not in a position to evaluate that myself, and I can't really see how anyone working for a particular database project can evaluate that. Just a quick rundown on what significant features we do support from SQL standards. All data types, all operators, your basic query language specification. So we import, we support inserts, updates, deletes, and all that thing. Distincts, group bys, having an alias as in the from field. We support predication, query expressions. So your basic set theory like union, intersect, except. Inner, left, right, outer, full, outer, cross and natural joins, which give different effects. And basic schema manipulation, that is creation of schemas, tables and all the other data storage mechanisms you'd be familiar with. We also support privileges on select, insert, update, delete, and references, which is foreign keys, sorry. Yes. No, not really. Like, in the scheme of things, still. Ah, yes. If you use it as a, in comparison, so if you say, case when blah equals meet some condition, and then compare it or find some equality between that and an attribute from another table, then you're in trouble because on the left-hand side you have to do a sequential scan. You can't do an index scan for non-trivial reasons, which I can explain in the BOF. We support data integrity constraints. Transactions, as I've detailed earlier, triggers on update, insert, and delete, and for situations before the particular event, after, and for each instance that it affects. Triggers are also another manipulation concept which really increases the usability and functionality and sophistication of an application with Postgres. Also support commenting. Okay, unsupported features I will go through at the BOF, unless anyone's particularly interested in them. Yeah. Okay. We don't support embedded SQL in a variety of arcane languages. Privileges are not supported at the column level for updating and references. There is no positioned update and delete within cursors. Yeah, yes, it is. In fact, several of these have been addressed. I read Peter's email yesterday, which says that he was working on with grant option, which under privileges there. So yes, they have been submitted, but it's not in CBS and it's not in a stable release. So yes, several of these are being worked on, and the to-do does very much follow these kinds of lists. We don't support the other transaction isolation levels. We have terrible error handling, as those of you who use Postgres and have used, say, Oracle will understand. It's almost impossible to identify what the nature of the error is. Lots of kind of like, gee, I'd really love to do this for 7.4. But no one has really stood up and taken the reins. Peter E. really wanted to work on it. I'm not sure if he's going to. It's a damn big job. Lots of Postgres-specific extensions, most of which I have covered in detail. I'll just I'll skip those and go to an example of vacuum. So you can see here with a vacuum full how we're actually shrinking the relation itself and consuming that space as opposed to marking it available for reuse. Analyze allows us to generate statistics for a given specified table. Those statistics are used by the planner in order to determine what the best possible way to access a relation is at that planning stage. I'll just quickly run over cluster. Cluster is a way of sorting a heap in terms of an index. That's important because if you look at this basic diagram of retrieving some information from a B-tree, say we were looking for, let's see, some tuple beginning with an A. We would go from the top of the, or bottom of the tree, we would sort through the tree, go to the less than F, go down to a leaf, find that it was A, then hit A here. Which is in, say, a page of tuples beginning with A. Say there was another A over here. We would need to read this page and this page in order to get all our possible results. Cluster allows us to group things in terms of an index. So if we were looking for, say, C or D, we could just simply go down through that tree and hopefully, or we have a better likelihood of finding all the or many related instances or results on the same number of pages. So we're decreasing I/O. I/O is essentially the limiting factor with databases. Does anyone have any questions about how that works? As of 7.3, no. That was a big problem beforehand. It was destructive. We can also use explain in order to debug a query. Once you start getting interested in performance of your queries, using explain is vital because it shows you exactly what the planner is doing and gives you suggestions as to how you can improve your query. For example, we are joining three tables here. This is a pretty stock standard select that you'll see. Up there, three-way join, and two of the tables have 1,000 rows. We are not using an index. A good reason for that is that I hadn't created them in order to show that. So if we created an index on A.I, B.I, and B.I, we would be almost guaranteed a much better plan because we would be using faster access methodologies. How do we know that we would have a better plan? The actual final cost of it up the top there would be much lower. The first cost is the startup cost, that is how long in Postgres units. This isn't anything discrete in time, just Postgres units, which you'll get a feel for with experience. How long before the first result is returned? And the other number is how long until all results are returned. The reason why There would be a startup cost, is the cost of hashing, cost of sorting, and so on. Does anyone have any questions about that? I was going to skip it, but asynchronous notification is not a relational concept. It's simply a message passing system. It just uses IPC in order to allow two listening connections to notify one another that certain conditions have been met. Why is this useful? As I've said before, relational databases are comparatively slow to something like BerkeleyDB, or much slower than in different circumstances, an in-memory hash. So if you had an application which was really hitting a database for reasonably static data very often, and data was only bulk loaded into this database, you could have a wrapper sitting on top of the database which cached requested values simultaneously. It's listening using the asynchronous notification keywords, it's listening for a condition to be met. That condition is that a modification has been made by another connection to the data, and that the application should now revise its cache. Very, very useful for situations like that. Not all that. Notifications will not be made. If I'm in a transaction, I do my work, I send a notify on a condition, I then roll back, the notification does not get sent. It's transaction safe. Any more questions about asynchronous notification?
You can't do that. You have to, all your front ends have to know.
That's right. Yes. Even though it might not seem like it, your application should be mimicking that. That is, there should be no unexpected event which the application has to start listening on. Well, at least not in the majority of circumstances that I can think of. I was going to work with 7.3 on the ability to pass a message with it, so to make it more useful, so that you could actually establish some sort of binary protocol between two applications through the database, but I didn't get around to it. Are there any other questions? Okay, PLPGSQL. How many people are seriously interested in PLPGSQL? It's a procedural language which is SQL-like, but it introduces things like control structures and so on into SQL so that you can actually code computationally complicated SQL-like applications and store them in the back end, create a function essentially with a pseudo SQL style language. Or we can look at C. It's Postgres specific. Lots of it has the feel of PL/SQL. Do we want to have a vote, or do people just want to continue with the talk as it is? Move on. Okay. It is reasonably easy, as you can see from the structure. It looks like SQL, and you know it's reasonably easy to pick up. Okay, C library. This is the final part of the talk. Sorry. Yes, I'll be in the city. The C library. We have a shared library containing all the functions, and libpq-fe.h is our header file. There are extensive examples within the source tree itself in order to learn more. We have three data structures which are widely used with C library applications. The first is pgcon, it's a pointer, and it's our connection handle. It's what we use in order to pass connection-based information. pgresult is our result handle, and pgnotify is the data structure which we use with asynchronous notification. So, database connection functions. The first function is pgconnectDB. To that you pass a connection string. The string is made up of name equals value pairs. I've listed the values there. They are host, specify a domain name, an IP address, or the path beginning with a slash to your Unix domain socket. We can specify the port, the database name, the user password, a connection timeout in seconds, options which I think would be best to ignore because they're more or less phased out, the TTY Unix terminal to send debugging information to, and an option to require SSL because the backend can downgrade and not allow SSL. Was there a question? No, it doesn't do anything like that. You create functions and it will return data like SQL, like a select would. You can call functions. If you like, because we don't have time, I'll... Yes. Yep. Okay. You can also check the status of a connection at any time, including before you've actually established it. A number of different results are possible. Connection OK and connection bad are the most obvious and most reliable ones. Connection OK means that the connection is established, it's fine, it's ready to go. Connection bad just means something is definitely wrong. And you'll need to reconnect. There are some other statuses which you should be aware of, but they shouldn't be relied upon because things are changing really so quickly. Those statuses you can set up there. They're well documented exactly what they mean in the manual. pgfinish closes the connection, the open connection. pgreset disconnects and attempts to reconnect. If the reconnect wasn't possible, you would need to use pqstatus in order to determine that. And pqErrorMessage returns any error messages which might be generated by the C library in trying to connect. Now I have some examples, very basic examples. The first one will, if you haven't had any experience with it yet, allow you to look at the different statuses which are available and which are returned, and this will simply just output stuff so you can see the connection establishment process in production. Does anyone have, just having a quick look at that code, does anyone have any questions about how it happens, how it works? On line 6, we simply declare our connection handle, we then connect to the database. On line 7, we then use pqstatus, switch the return, and see what the status of our connection is. Sorry? Yes, I would be connected as a trusted user there, yes. And finally, we exit. Were there any more questions about that example? I mean, database connection is pretty trivial stuff. You can pass the password in clear text. Yes, different algorithms are supported, as well as different authentication mechanisms. particularly if you're running on a public across a public network, you also want to look at things like SSL or... I don't know the answer to that question. Possibly. We also have the possibility of non-blocking connections. Non-blocking connections are desirable when using Postgres, and particularly with complicated applications, which may open several database connections, because database startup time, which I referred to in the past, is reasonably long in CPU time. This means that if we want to connect in a non-blocking way, connect at the very start or entry point of our application, do so in a non-blocking way, and then when we're actually ready to get around to interacting with the database, which might be, you know, hundreds of thousands of CPU cycles later, it's more likely that a lot of the work which needs to be done by the database in order to start up has already been done while our application's been starting up, particularly if the application runs on a different machine to the database. We have several two functions essentially which are used here. The first is a PQ connect start. We provide the same con info string, but executing that function does not guarantee, in fact it does anything but, it does not guarantee that the connection has been made. In order to determine if a connection is ready to be used, we must use Postgres polling, PQ connect poll, that is to poll the status of the connection. Any of the six possible results may be returned. The result that we're essentially looking for is pgres underscore polling underscore OK, which means that the connection is correctly established, and it can be used by any of the it can be used by any of the other routines in the library. I've got a quick example there because in a non-blocking framework, people might want to use some networking logic in order to determine when would be the most appropriate time to check whether the connection has taken place. It's complicated enough, and I presume that people want to get out of here sometime today. So you can look at, if you're interested, you can look at that later on. As I said, it will be on the CD. I moved on because this is probably the stuff that you're more interested in, actually executing a query. The first function that I want to look at is PQ escape string. PQ escape string turns special characters into escape characters to be used at the SQL level. This is important in order to avoid SQL injection attacks, which are an increasingly hot sort of topic in with surge of web-based applications which are being developed, particularly PHP it seems. But if you are developing a application which receives untrusted data, you really need to use PQ escape string. PQ exec is the actual function which executes the query. It is blocking. It will block until the query result, all the query results have been returned to the application. It takes its first argument, a connection handle. If the connection handle was invalid, it will return. The second argument is simply a string, the query itself. Once the connection has been returned, we can use PQ result status in order to determine whether or not the query returned successfully, whether or not it returned any data, and so on. That is to determine how we should proceed in our application. I've listed all of the all the possible return types there. The most interesting ones are probably pgres underscore empty underscore query, that is no results were returned. Command OK says that the query ran correctly, but it did not return any results because it was not a select statement. PGres underscore tuple tuples underscore OK mean that it was a select query, it ran successfully, and it returned results. And then there's the non-fatal and fatal errors, which are reasonably descriptive. We have some support routines, PQN tuples and PQN fields, which allow us to determine the dimensions of the result. We generally know how many fields there are because we would have specified it, but N tuples allows us to determine the number of results, that is how many times we're going to have to loop through the results. PQ result error message gets us the error message sent from the back end, and PQ clear actually frees the underlying memory used by the query, which I referred to earlier on. Now, I have an example of basically how to execute a single query and retrieve the results. To do this, we first of all connect to the database on line 9, where once again we're a trusted user. We check the result status. If it's bad, we error out, telling the user what the error message was. We then execute our query, which is just a basic query, one that any application would be expected to execute. It's a select statement, so we expect to have tuples returned. If we aren't, we generate an error, again telling the user that it wasn't possible. If everything's fine, we fall through to line 21, where we loop for the number of results in our result set. We then also loop for the number of fields within that result set, providing information to the user, such as the field name followed by the actual value that was returned. Finally, we clear the result, even though it would not be all that useful in this particular example because we're exiting immediately, close the connection and return to the user. Does anyone have any questions about that? Sorry, I can't hear you. That would best be determined at application creation time. If you're deploying an application on a machine that you aren't familiar with, and the application is sufficiently complicated enough that you don't want to set that to a high timeout, you could run a test to determine how long you could expect to do that. But yes, it's not a clear-cut kind of thing. I mean, on a everyday kind of machine, it really doesn't take that long in human time to connect. Persistent connections, yes. Well, they're persistent connections. So the idea is for them to persist externally to the application itself. Any other questions? Okay, there's also a non-blocking framework which is provided. This is particularly important because, again, if we're interested in performance here and our application is sufficiently complicated that it has to do other things besides merely retrieve or update information relating to a database, then we really want to maximise our time and get the most out of our application. The functions involved in non-blocking query execution. First of all, PQ set non-blocking. This is actually given a connection handle. We can set the non-blocking status of it so that it does actually behave that way. PQ send query actually sends, or as I've said, there buffers the query because the underlying library, the underlying C functions and system calls might not necessarily dispatch that immediately. In fact, the entire idea behind it is to not, unless it's necessary, send that immediately. Because we don't know if they will be sent immediately, we also have PQ flush, which is a wrapper to flush, which will flush the underlying buffer and ensure that the data is sent. Mind you, because it's non-blocking, we might have a positive return value to PQ flush, which is the number of bytes, I believe, which are still outstanding in the buffer. Or is it? Anyway, the manual clarifies what it is, but if it's not zero, then we didn't flush the entire buffer and we will have to subsequently call our PQ flush until everything's gone, if we are indeed waiting for the query to be processed. PQ consume input does the reverse. When we are waiting for a result to be sent back, we have to call PQ consume input in order to read data from the underlying mechanisms into a internal buffer so that we can do things like PQ is busy and PQ get result. PQ is busy will allow us to look in the underlying buffer, see what the server is telling us, namely if it's still processing the query, and if so, we still need to wait. Once PQ is busy is failed, we can then call PG get result and use the query processing routines which we saw on the previous slide. Using non-blocking IO, we can also use PQ request cancel, which sends a cancel request to the back end if some application level timeout has been met or if some other condition has taken place, such as the user clicking a cancel button or something to that effect. And that allows us to actually stop the query in its tracks and return to normal processing within the application. Does anyone have any questions about non-blocking IO at all? Not on the same connection. Actually, that was the example which I was going to come back to earlier. If you send another query to a PQ is busy connection, you are possibly corrupting that connection because it's currently processing something. So before using a PG con handle, you need to check whether or not that particular connection is being used or not. That's only for non-blocking. No. Let me think. Well, that's essentially what you want cursors for, yes. Yeah, that's correct. Let me think. Yeah, you can't access them before they're all received. One would occur that is a deficiency of it. I can't think off the top of my head, other than increased complexity in the library, I can't think of a good reason why that... Actually, I can, because then your result retrieval function would have to block. Do you understand what I mean? Like, first of all, you don't know how many tuples have been returned. Say you invented a new mechanism within the library to simply process them as they come, which is fair enough. Once you depleted your local buffer, a subsequent call to something like PQ get result or PQ get val would have to block. Yeah. That's probably the reason, and maybe there's some other even better ones. Well, yes. Unfortunately, no, there is no signal handling. It seems like a reasonable... Yeah.
So once that stuff on there, you call it 2 degrees.
Right. Yeah, but...
You have to do that, and then you need to get the two more stuff, 2 degrees.
Yes, if you specify no timeout in your select, you could rig it up yourself. But, yeah. Did you have a... Yeah, so... Certainly a popular use for this kind of non-blocking framework is when you're not just interested in I.O. with Postgres, but some other kind of network or file system I.O. where you're waiting on several things to happen at once. Naturally, using select, you can monitor various file descriptors at once, both reading and writing, and depending on the result, process information in different ways. So that might be a command result turning up, it might be some information coming off a TCP network, it might be some information from some other file descriptor. Obviously that adds a significant level of application complexity as opposed to just typing open and read and stuff like that and doing it all sequentially, but for high throughput applications, for applications which have much more to do than just sit around all day waiting for Postgres or waiting for some network event to take place, that's vital. Sorry, what do you mean by normal synchronous function calls? In the underlying library. No, you can't.
Right.
No. Not at all. They're all outright blocking. Unfortunately, yeah, that's how it works. Now. Naturally, the fact is that usually and hopefully queries don't take, computationally speaking, that much time. It's only when you're dealing in very high throughput situations that you really learn the benefits of this. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm using it with that open
Are there any more questions about that? How? Neither of them are blocking. So that, for example, if you, and I haven't detailed the function here, in fact, this is the last main slide, using the asynchronous notification framework, the notice will be sent through inside the back-end front-end protocol, but it won't necessarily be, it won't be made apparent to the application until it actually checks whether or not that's taken place. So the underlying library reads the information off the wire and sort of goes, this is a result from a query, this is a message relating to listen, notify, asynchronous notification style thing, caches them or buffers them and waits for the wrapper, the functions that sit on top of those to actually dig into that. So you could have been notified of some event taking place, your application just for some reason never polls that, and that's it, you never find out that that's the case. So that's why it is non-blocking. Sorry, I didn't catch that.
Why has two different implementations for blocking and non-blocking when blocking is really just non-blocking, but you run CPUs to block?
The underlying library, that is the internal functions within libpq, use the non-blocking interface and then select on the socket to determine when it's finished. The non-blocking interface is much simpler for your average user. And so all of this complexity that you see on this page, sorry? The blocking interface uses the non-blocking interface, but selects on the socket waiting for a result to come back. From the user's perspective, it's just non-blocking, yeah. It's as if you've opened the socket with a non-blocking, and marked it non-blocking, so the user gets exactly the same result. That's right. It's essentially mimicking exactly what the C library does. In fact, I dare say that that's really the inspiration. There's only really one way to do it. So just some basic resources, mostly just the Postgres websites, specific hosts for specific requirements. There's also a Postgres channel on Freenode, just called PostgreSQL. Are there any more questions? Wednesday? Tomorrow evening. I'm way too tired to do it now. Proposed, yes. I can not even get close to guaranteeing that they will take place. The biggest changes that need to get in are error handling, basically, and possibly some stuff relating to prepared queries, which I didn't get time to cover. Are you saying last time as in 7.2?
Yeah.
Well, it just happened again in 7.3. We're setting something of a trend in, not bumping version numbers in binary, in front-end, back-end protocols and in other sections such as libraries. So we were, really trying to live up to the roots of the project at large. And, yeah. That's Chris. Yes, it lots of people are saying now's the time to do it. It's an open source project. Peter E might just decide that, he wants to get a sex change or something like that and become a cabaret dancer. I don't know. Those Germans, you never really know what they're going to do. And Chris or whoever else is working on some other aspect of it might want to join Peter or something, I don't know. And there might not be a binary, a front and back end protocol change. But I would expect that there would be. Like, there's not that many other major things, other than replication and point in time recovery, which are being lauded for 7.4. Mostly ones in Berlin and Dresden from memory. Where else does Peter E like to go to when he does that thing of his? No, I've never met Peter Reed, I don't know. Anyway, any other questions?
Yeah, you didn't get a chance to talk about the API in the back end of Postgres.
I know, I didn't talk about stacks of stuff, whether it was actually in the original talk or not. I mean, I didn't talk about triggers at all, SPI, which is what you were talking about. SPI, Server Programming Interface. At all, didn't talk about things like creating user-defined types, user-defined functions.
I just wonder what feedback you've had from other places out there with the new version, the version
7.3.
Yeah, there's two versions of the SPI. The one and the newer one.
That's correct. Okay, I haven't heard that before. But mind you, I haven't really heard that much about SPI, and I can't. Yeah, it's probably not suitable for this.
What compiles use simple programming interfaces? Are there any significant limits still
present with the code, which
No, as I said earlier, major developers are using several different platforms, not just PCs. Most importantly, Tom Lane uses 64-bit HPUX, so he thinks that integers are, you know, 8 bytes in size. So no, to my knowledge, there are no intrinsic limits except for OID sizes. The object identifier sizes are 4 byte. Sure. Sure. So if anyone, yeah. Not if the JDBC driver maintainers update their code. Otherwise, yes, it will. Well, yes, it may. I don't think the major aspects of the protocol will be changed, but I don't know, again, because there's not enough real detail about it. The project isn't really run like other projects. Most people just sort of go away for 3 months.